C1F. Number 8A.
We come to the second subject of spirit. I think what I will do is not to take the subtones anymore, but they are so easy to study with the text that they offer really no difficulty, and it isn't necessary really that I explain them. The main thing is that now we just get the feel of the second part, which shows the divinity of humanity, showing that the human is not just the mortal, but that the human is the shining through of the divine, and that we have so much divinity within ourselves that if we make use of that divinity in ourselves, that we feel really that we are God in expression, that we are not something that has to reach heaven, but that it is God in its presence. The first subject showed that we should make use of our thinking, and that thought can do so much. And if thought is borrowed from the divine mind, as it is shown, that if thought is borrowed from the divine mind, then we have always a holy influence on our surroundings, as a mother does. Here in spirit, she appeals to another quality which each one of us has, which is not just a special gift to a few, but each one has, namely spiritual receptivity. Each one can be spiritually receptive. It's up to each one that he opens up his heart to the love for the infinite, the spiritual. The love for the spiritual is not a love for something which is highfalutin, spirit that cannot be touched, that has no identity, no definiteness or anything like that. Opening up one's thought for the infinite is really opening up our thought for the spiritual, because the spiritual is that which has no limits. The moment we put any limit on spirit, we have a material universe. So, really, we can, through our thought, open up our heart to that which has no limits, and that's being receptive for the spiritual. She shows that this ability to be receptive is really the basis for any progress, for any true progress. I feel we have learned very religiously in our study of the synonyms that spirit is unfoldment and development and brings progress and success. And each one would like to have progress and unfoldment, but the question is, how do we get it? Only because it is a fact in being, we have not experienced it. And here the second part always shows how we get those ideas. And it is that in the measure as we are receptive for the spiritual, that then progress takes place within us. Progress is not something which we have to bring about. Progress is something which is self-acting, because it's the order of spirit, and comes into demonstration and comes into becomes concrete being the moment we are receptive for the new. She speaks a lot here about children who have that natural quality of being receptive for the new, and that only as we get older we lose that faculty because we burn our fingers too often. So we have to be consciously aware that spiritual receptivity is a quality which we have to culture consciously. The child has it naturally, without culturing. That's why we lose it. If the child would understand the necessity for being receptive, we wouldn't lose it. But it is not understood by the child, and therefore as we grow up, we lose it. Therefore, we have to regain it, so to say, now on the basis of understanding. On that basis of understanding, which shows that in the measure as we lay down all material conceptions, as we lay down everything in consciousness which has limitations of any kind or sort, then we are spiritually receptive. Then the infinite can break in on our consciousness. Then the new idea has room to unfold itself. Therefore, if we want to make progress, we don't have to seek where we can make progress and how to make progress. No, the only thing we have to do is to get into that state of being receptive for the new, whatever the new then will be. Humanly, we can never outline what the new will be, what the progress will be, what our mission will be, what our next great duty will be. We can never outline it. And it's perhaps just here that it is right to take it to our present problem that we part today for an indefinite time, and not to be sorry about it, but to see that all that is needed is to be receptive for something new, though we don't know what the future brings. I don't know, you may not know it, and I hope you don't know it, and I hope I don't know it, what it is, because it would be humanly circumscribed. But the Divine Spirit is unfoldment. That's His very nature. That's the nature of being, evolution, spiritual evolution. And that's its very nature. And therefore, if we have the dignity to go and open our thought so wide that we lose every preconceived notion of what is going to happen with us, how it is going to happen with the idea, in which line the idea might unfold and should unfold, if we just drop everything right away, right, put it right behind us, and see it's something completely new. And I'm ready for, I don't know what's coming. Whatever is coming, I accept it, if it is from God. Then the Divine Spirit has a chance to bring to fruition that which is slumbering within us and is ready to burst into the open. I'm glad we finished today. I'm glad we are no more meeting. And you will be glad. And if you feel, what shall we do without Max coming? It's not right. You have been coming for many, many times under great sacrifices, many of you, with great costs, many of you. Why have you been coming? Not because I could give you something, because something in you was there that longed to be fortified, strengthened, but it was there. It is in us. I can't graft my understanding on your ignorance. We only can come together, and we come together through the very fact that in each one of us was something has something which is already there. And that attracts each other and one another. So it's there. It's in each one. And it's there just to grow and to grow. And it will grow stronger and sturdier if we give it rest and peace and quietude and stillness and worship and adoration and hope. And if we expect the greatest to happen, then we are mother. Then we give birth to something that is ready to come to the front. And that's being receptive. The next big subject is soul. I epitomized it as saying, through transformation of human thought, we overcome sin, the senses, the body, and our own ego. You see the tone of soul here as, first of all, transformation. That's the humanity of it. We transform. And what is coming out is our true ego. We lose the false sense of ego, the sense of the body, and what is coming out is the divinity of humanity, namely our true I, our true self. That self which is free from body, free from senses. What a wonderful I, what a wonderful self that is. If we get rid and rid more and more of the concept that we are identified with a body and a slave to the senses that slave the body. That enslaves the body, sorry. Here we find that the true sense of being, the true identity of being, is always there. And that it is just hidden away from us because of our misinterpretation of what is. She starts in and says that the laws of nature are the laws of God and that they are kinder and more and nicer than our material views on nature. Meaning by this that the identity of everything is really a fact. And that only because we have misunderstood these facts, misinterpreted these facts, that we don't see the identity of being as they are. We see through a glass darkly, so to say. We have misinterpreted the true universe. And therefore, in order to re-establish in thought the true universe, a retranslation is necessary. And soul retranslates everything back into the divine mind. This is the main tone of this soul. And we see in it really this, that no one is shut out from reaching harmony, because each one can change his attitude towards being. See, in this second part of this chapter, she appeals always to those qualities which each one of us has, not to some qualities which are only a gift to a few chosen ones, but which is innate in every human being. Here she appeals to the ability to transform our consciousness, to transform and translate our misconception about all things into the true identification of everything. And that alone really dissolves the ego. The last tone under it is that it dissolves our ego, so that only the divine ego is left over. Then we come to principle, and in principle she appeals to another quality which each one has, namely to understanding of the science of being. And that this understanding of the science of being has a divine power within itself, that the divinity is that humanity has a divinity in itself, namely that it demonstrates, as she says, life, truth, and love. Actually, here we find in the as the middle subject of principle, we find that through mind, spirit, and soul, our understanding can be channelized into an understanding of the divine principle. But that which principle does is that it demonstrates itself as life, truth, and love. That we don't have to go and demonstrate life, truth, and love. All what we have to do, she shows here, is to be in harmony, to be synchronized with, to be lined up with, to be in concord with the divine principle, by having but one mind, the mind of God, instead of ignorance, that we can learn this principle, because this is the faculty that has been given to the present age. Therefore, Christian Science could not have come 3,000 years ago, because 3,000 years ago people were not yet awake to the fact that they could reason things out logically. Therefore, Christian Science could not have come before. First, the human intellect had to be trained into scientific, logical reasoning. And only in this way the preparation has been made for the appearance of Christian Science as a science. But if it appears as a science today, it doesn't mean that it will always appear as a science. I'm not going to let myself be crucified over this statement. Why should Christian Science, now why should being, always come as a science? The time will come when we will grow further out of it into a very natural sense of being science, of being, that's of being. At this present moment, Mrs. Eddy says that divine metaphysics is now reduced to a system, and for the present age, and adapted to the present situation, because we are living in a scientific age, and therefore it speaks to us through science. But it is not the only way that being is speaking. Science is a human working tool to understand being. It's a working tool. Being itself is not science. Being itself is translated to us as science. We have to be clear about that. Being is being. Being itself, for itself, does not need a science to understand itself. That should be clear, that being itself, in order to know itself, does not need a science. Science is that wonderful tool which is given to our present age, which is adapted to bring order and classifications into our thinking, into our model of thinking, so that it is able to grasp a new subject. But it is not God himself, being himself. Being knows itself as being. It not even has to know itself. It being bees itself. Being is being. No wonder that the professor of physics, who recently has written a book on physics, very well-known professor of physics, not just a little one, that he says, the way is clear. It is the way through science, but past science. And that's what she wants to show here in this fourth subject. That the way is through science, to the principle. It's understanding, scientifically understanding the divine principle. And I cannot understand the divine principle except through mind and spirit and soul, because mind is that which makes understanding possible. It is through spirit, because it must resolve limitations, which is matter, and because it must overcome the belief that only that is real which the five physical senses testify, then I touch principle. But when I touch principle, principle says, I am what I am. I am life, I am truth, I am love. I am demonstrating myself. And she shows that here very clearly, that it says in mind, you can't approach the signs of being through ignorance. You must have inspiration, and only inspiration restores the whole garment. As spirit, she says, you can't do it just with the letter. You need the spirit of it. As soul, she says, you can't do that through material sense and testimony of the physical senses. But then, when she touches principle, she says, and principle then declares what principle is, and says, I am life, truth, and love. And truth, life, and love, she says, here is a law of annihilation to whatever is unlike God, because it declares nothing except God. Again, you see how she leads thought, always through the level of Christian Science, to touch absolute Christian Science, to lead the thought slowly up. It seems to be up, but it isn't up, because mind, spirit, and soul are not up and down, but we call it like this. It leads thought to the point of touching principle, and then touch principle, it says principle is going to take over, and it demonstrates itself as only that which God is: life, truth, and love. And that is a law of annihilation to whatever is unlike itself. Because once we have somehow seen the unity with principle, then we know that we are principle's idea and principle in operation. So that we can't do anything anymore but let principle happen. Let there be life, truth, and love. Then we have somehow passed science into being. Then being is taking over. We come to the subject of life. Here again, she appeals to the remnant in us and says, I appeal to that in you which everyone has. It's not hidden from anyone. Namely, our views of existence must be molded by eternal life. Each one of us has it in his hand according to what model he wants to shape his life. If we want to shape our lives according to the model of birth, maturity, decrepitude, decay, death, we want to shape our lives according to the miseries of this life experience, or if with our mind we make that transformation and say we have it in our own hands to look at everything with the divine mind, then I see but life. But life. So each one of us has it in his hand to drop the false sense of life with beginning, with end, with birth, with death, and see life as being. In that very first subtone, she shows how youth and age are mental conditions. I would like to stay on this point a little bit, because we are always so much engaged in the question, what is death? What is after death? How could we postpone death? How could we die nicely, comfortably? Books are written, many books are written about death. How few books are written about birth? Books are written, Life After Death. Have you ever heard about the book Life Before Birth? But how can we solve a problem by beginning at the end instead of at the beginning? Trying to solve the problem of death, which puzzles everybody, by starting at the end, namely death, we should start at the beginning. If we would give all that time which we give to the question of death and after death, to the question of before birth, then I think we would get somewhere. We can't solve the question of death without solving the question of birth, because death is only the last end of what happened in the first place, birth. We make ourselves pictures how it may be after death. Do you think I will meet so-and-so and so again? Do you think I will also have a factory and run a factory as I have now and enjoy myself as I do now? Do you think I will see my children and my parents and so on? Has anybody asked what was the picture before birth? But birth was the first death. With birth, we died into mortality. And if we would like to solve the question of death, we must solve the question of birth.